I invite you now to take your Bibles and turn to Genesis chapter 34. Our text today is in chapter 34 and 35. We've entitled the message, The Incident at Shechem and Journey's End. The Incident at Shechem and Journey's End. With that title, we see we're coming to an end or a conclusion here in this part of the book of Genesis. What we're bringing to a conclusion is the section entitled The Generations of Isaac, or the Hebrew term, the Toledoth of Isaac. This began back in Genesis 25 and verse 19. It says, these are the generations of Isaac. Now, if you'll recall, if you've been with us here in our studies in Genesis, that these section headings used by Moses, that the person who is named, such as in ours here, the generations of Isaac, the person named is usually not the main figure in the ensuing narrative, but rather he is the point of origin. And really what we have in these sections is we're being told what became of the person in terms of their children. These are the generations of Isaac, or this is what became of Isaac. Esau and Jacob. He goes on to tell the story. I find it intriguing that the history of Genesis and the story of the patriarchs is told, their history is told in terms of what became of their children. Think of yourself in that setting. What would your story be? What will it be? Of course, we all don't know yet, unless to some degree there are those of us who are older here. Children and grandchildren, to some degree, no. Take your name and say, this is what became of, put your name in there. And then put the name of your children, and then the story. Interesting. What our children do, and where they go, is a continuation, or it's telling the world what became of us. What became of Isaac? Well, to know what became of Isaac, you've got to study Jacob. Study his life. And of course, also of his brother Esau, who was intimately involved in the story as well. The section in Genesis 25:19 through to the end here of chapter 35 concerning Isaac focuses, though, particularly upon Jacob. And the reason why is he is the heir of faith. Faith of his father, Isaac. He is the heir of the Abrahamic covenant. Isaac himself, in this section bearing his name, is really only the center of the narrative in one chapter. That is chapter 26. Though he is important in some other sections as well, he is only the center. The focus is upon Jacob, and as we continue now in this section, this narrative, the generations of Isaac, we continue our focus on Jacob in chapters 34 and 35. And what we have here is the final aspect of God's promises to Jacob. At the time when he left Canaan, those promises given at that time are now brought to a fulfillment. Brought to a fulfillment. And in chapter 29 through 35, what we have had, as we've mentioned each week as we've been looking at Jacob here, is we have the fulfillment of God's promises to him as the heir of the Abrahamic covenant, particularly the promises that relate to Jacob's own lifetime. And there were three in number. First was the promise of fruitfulness, which we have seen being fulfilled. God blessed him, and he was fruitful, gave him 12 sons and daughters. We know of one daughter, perhaps many more. We were not aware of that, though. Secondly, he blessed him with wealth and prosperity. We saw that in chapter 30 and 31. The final aspect of the promise, when Jacob was fleeing from his brother, Esau had sworn to kill him, God promised that he would be with Jacob and return him safely to Canaan. And when Jacob responded to the vision, he set up a pillar and he poured oil upon it and he made a vow. And he said, when the Lord has returned me safely to my father's house, then will the Lord be my God. And he would offer him the tithe and so forth and so on. And so what we've been tracing the last few weeks is the last aspect of this promise. The return to Canaan by Jacob and to his father Isaac. And to safely return, he had to do, well, the three things these chapters show. First of all, he had to escape Laban. Had to escape his father-in-law, Laban. Which he did by God's providence. For Laban had set to do him harm, but God restrained him. Secondly, he had to be reconciled to Esau. This we studied last week. The reconciliation that took place between Jacob and Esau. But the chapter before us today shows another danger. And it relates to a particular incident, a very sorry incident, perhaps one of the most tragic and shocking incidents in the whole book of Genesis. And it's to be delivered from the danger that threatens him because of his son's murderous vengeance on the Shechemites. And that's the theme of chapter 34. The murderous vengeance of the sons of Jacob against the Shechemites. But chapter 35 shows us that even though this now exposed Jacob to tremendous danger because of the surrounding peoples and tribes who would want to avenge this stranger and sojourner's murderous act, God delivers Jacob from the danger, that danger as well. Gordon Wenham, I think, sums it up very, very pertinently concerning what we're looking at in 34 and 35 and how it fits into the theme and flow of this portion of Genesis. He says concerning these chapters, its program is summed up in 28:13-15, which reaffirms the familiar Abrahamic promises of land and descendants, but adds, I am really with you and will guard you wherever you go and bring you back to this land, because I will not leave you until I have done for you what I have promised to you. 28:15. Then Jacob made a vow that if God would do this and bring him back, quote, in peace to my father's house, the Lord will be my God. End of quote, chapter 28:20-21. By the end of chapter 33, Jacob has enjoyed divine protection in Mesopotamia, gained descendants, and bought land in Canaan, but has not quite reached his destination in Bethel. Here, on the verge of the total fulfillment of the promise and his vow, Canaanite lust, his own cowardice, and his son's folly all combine to destroy the prospect of Jacob's return to his father's house in peace. Yet he does make it. As often in Genesis, the invincibility of the promises is once again demonstrated. Divine grace triumphs despite human sin. First this morning, we will read and survey the chapter in chapter 34, the incident at Shechem, and then want to draw some applications on that and then move on to the chapter 35 where we see the end of the journey. So the incident at Shechem, chapter 34, chapter 35, the end of the journey. I'm going to read the whole chapter here first and then make some comments. And Dinah, the daughter of Leah, which she bare unto Jacob, went out to see the daughters of the land. And when Shechem, the son of Hamor, the Hivite, prince of the country, saw her, he took her and lay with her and defiled her. And his soul clave unto Dinah, the daughter of Jacob. And he loved the damsel and spake kindly unto the damsel. And Shechem spake unto his father Hamor, saying, get me this damsel to wife. And Jacob heard that he had defiled Dinah, his daughter. Now his sons were with his cattle in the field. Jacob held his peace until they were come. And Hamor, the father of Shechem, went out unto Jacob to commune with him. And the sons of Jacob came out of the field when they heard it. And the men were grieved, and they were very wroth, because he had wrought folly in Israel in lying with Jacob's daughter, which thing ought not to be done. And Hamor communed with them, saying, the soul of my son Shechem longeth for your daughter. I pray you give her him to wife. And make ye marriages with us, and give your daughters unto us, and take our daughters unto you. And ye shall dwell with us, and the land shall be before you. Dwell and trade ye therein, and get you possessions therein. And Shechem said unto her father, and unto her brethren, Let me find grace in your eyes, and what you shall say unto me, I will give. Ask me never so much dowry and gift, and I will give it according as ye shall say unto me. But give me the damsel, the wife. And the sons of Jacob answered Shechem and Hamor, his father, deceitfully, and said, because he had defiled Dinah, their sister. And they said unto them, we cannot do this thing to give our sister to one that is uncircumcised, for that were a reproach unto us. But in this we will consent unto you. You will be as we be, that every male of you be circumcised. Then will we give our daughters unto you, and we will take your daughters unto us. And we will dwell with you, and we will become one people. But if you will not hearken unto us to be circumcised, then we will take our daughter, and we will be gone. And their words pleased Hamor and Shechem, Hamor's son. And the young man deferred not to do the thing, because he had delight in Jacob's daughter, and he was more honorable than all the house of his father. And Hamor and Shechem, his son, came unto the gate of their city and communed with the men of their city, saying, these men are peaceable with us. Therefore let them dwell in the land and trade therein. For the land, behold, it is large enough for them. Let us take their daughters to us for wives, and let us give them our daughters. Only herein will the men consent unto us for to dwell with us, to be one people, if every male among us be circumcised, as they are circumcised, shall not their cattle and their substance and every beast of theirs be ours? Only let us consent unto them, and they will dwell with us. And unto Hamor and unto Shechem his sons hearkened all that went out of the gate of his city, and every male was circumcised, all that went out of the gate of his city. And it came to pass on the third day, when they were sore, that two of the sons of Jacob, Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brethren, took each man his sword and came upon the city boldly and slew all the males. And they slew Hamor and Shechem his son with the edge of the sword and took Dinah out of Shechem's house and went out. The sons of Jacob came upon the slain and spoiled the city because they had defiled their sister. They took their sheep and their oxen and their asses, and that which was in the city and that which was in the field, and all their wealth and all their little ones and their wives took they captive, and spoiled even all that was in the house. And Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, ye have troubled me to make me to stink among the inhabitants of the land, among the Canaanites and the Perizzites. And I being few in number, they shall gather themselves together against me and slay me. And I shall be destroyed, I and my house. And they said, should he deal with our sister as with an harlot? Let us take a look now at this text and make a few observations on it that we might better understand what is taking place here. In verses 1 to 4, as we have read, we see where Shechem takes Dinah and lays with her. And the result is his soul cleaves to her, or as we might say today, he falls in love with her and he desires, apparently very sincerely and truly, to marry her. But it's interesting how this chapter begins in the definition, or the identification, I should rather say, of Dinah. It's rather lengthy. It says here that Dinah was the daughter of Leah, which she bare unto Jacob. Now what do we know from our earlier study of the family situation there in Jacob's household? Well, we know that he loved Rachel. But Leah he did not. His favored wife was Rachel, but Leah was less than favored. And there was great rivalry within the household between the women. And also, as this chapter will begin to develop, and we'll see in the story of Joseph, between the children as well. We have to remember we have a divided household, a polygamous situation, and they're divided. And this identification may be helping us understand some of the things that are at work in this story. Some of the family and emotional situations or factors that are at work here. We know that Jacob has his favorites. And the favorites are the sons of his beloved Rachel. The story of Joseph plunges ahead because of his favoritism for Joseph, the children of Rachel. When we see how Jacob responds to this situation in this chapter, he seems to me to be strangely passive. You'll note in the negotiations, it mentions him, but he soon slips out of the picture, and the negotiations are carried on with who? The sons of Jacob. Is it because that Jacob himself is really not that concerned about Dinah because of the family jealousies and rivalry? If this would have been, if he had any daughters, which we do not have any indication he did, but let's say that Rachel would have had a daughter and this would have happened to Rachel's daughter, would Jacob have been so passive? I mean, we're trying to understand why Jacob is just not in the picture here after the first few lines. In fact, it says when he first hears about it, he's silent. When he talks with Hamor, there's no remonstrance from him. And I think the silence and reserve that we see in Jacob in this chapter do not really put him in a good light. In fact, perhaps chapter 34 shows Jacob in his most unfavorable light in the whole Jacob narrative. Secondly, I want you to know what it says about Dinah. That she went out to see the daughters of the land. Now, these terms may suggest, and I think they do, though we cannot be certain, suggest that Dinah is at fault here at least to some degree in this whole chapter. The way this is worded, we have the suggestion this was not accepted or normal practice. It certainly was not safe for a woman to go out unattended. Canaanites were notorious for their lust and for their sexual sins. The Canaanites considered an unattended woman as fair game. It's hard to believe that Jacob or Dinah's mother Leah was not aware of this. And that we ask the question, did she go out with parental permission? She just decided she wanted an adventure on her own and go out. Another interesting factor pointed out by Gordon Wenham is the term here, went out, as it is used in the Hebrew, Akkadian. It was used when a woman acted improperly outside of her home. So again, this may suggest to us that when it says she went out to see the daughters of the land, that she was going out in an improper way. She was curious. She went out to see the daughters of the land. Well, we might say, well, that seems safe enough going to see the daughters. Well, remember, if the daughters are corrupt and licentious like the rest of the Canaanites, they're not the ones you want your daughter to be with. Not only that, going out with the daughters of the land means she will soon have contact with what? The sons of the land as well. And so my own opinion on this is that Dinah is at least partially responsible for what happens here. Certainly Shechem acts evilly in taking her and laying with her, but she has put herself in this situation. And look at all the horror that descends from this. Perhaps an innocent act in her mind. I'm just going to go out. I'm a little bit curious. I'd like to go out and see this. Do we see how these kind of things can lead to such tragedy as recorded in this chapter? A whole city is, the men are all killed. The women and children taken captive. It's just a very tragic story. And it may have been precipitated by a young girl. She's probably about 14, 16, around that age, by her curiosity. Young people, don't let curiosity control you. Stay under the care and protection and obedience of your parents. There's a teenager who thought they could explore a little bit. And she went out unattended. And disaster fell upon her and many others. We see verse 2 here and we look at the actions of Shechem. We have the echo here of Genesis chapter 3 and the picture that is given in Genesis and throughout the Bible of the process of sin. Remember what happened there in the Garden of Eden? The woman saw the fruit. She took it. The action, she ate it. The result, defilement of sin. What it says here about Shechem. He saw her. He took her. He lay with her. The action of sin. And defiled her. That's the process of sin. we see something and our lust, our pride, whatever, is excited. We want what we see. And so, we act upon that. We reach for it. We take it. And we're defiled. Because the thing that we have taken is forbidden by the law of God. And surely Dinah was forbidden by the law of God to Shechem. Shechem was a corrupt Canaanite. He acted according to his lusts. And so not only is Dinah, as we have spoken of her, but this young man, unable to control his lusts, defiles a young lady, brings death upon himself and his father and his whole city. Young men, control yourselves. These things are not to be trifled with. They're explosive and dangerous. It's the common practice of today. Young ladies wandering out unattended, looking for action, excitement. Young men filled with lust, taking the young ladies, laying with them, defiling them. Think we that they will escape? No, they won't. And though the effects may not be as severe as here, though in some ways they may be, we will not escape. We cannot violate God's order without it. And so this chapter begins some very pertinent thoughts for us in a licentious society similar in its lust craziness to the Canaanites. A young girl wanders out, and a young man sees her. And disaster strikes. Another thing to note about the Genesis 3 passage in relation to what we see in 1 and 2 here is, we talked about this earlier, should Eve have been talking to the serpent? Our conclusion was no. The very moment this happened, she should have gone and got Adam and said, Adam, something strange happening here. And brought him as her, the one from whom she was taken, the one for whom she was given as a helper fit for him, should have brought Adam in. So we have the similar, I think, evidence that Dinah was acting as a woman improperly. Just as Eve acted improperly. And not being under the authority and protection of her husband, Dinah was not under the authority and protection of her father. And look what happens. This is also, though, not a challenge to the young folks, but to the parents. Let we, our daughters, go out unattended. They're old enough they can take care of themselves. Not when Shechems are around. Strong young men who can force themselves against our daughters. We need to protect them. Even the more so as the society in which one lives is evil. Let us take note. Let us take note as fathers to train our sons in self-control, lest we bring disaster on our household. Now in verses 5 to 19, we looked at the marriage negotiations. We read these, the marriage negotiations that took place between Hamor and his son Shechem and Jacob and his sons. One thing that illuminates a little bit about some cultural practices here. Remember back in Genesis chapter 24 when the servant of Abraham went to find a wife? Poor Isaac. Remember how Laban, the brother of Rebekah, was so involved in the negotiations there? And it was the father and the son who gave approval? This seems to indicate that in the cultural thinking of the day, that grown brothers, brothers of age, who were in a position to protect their sisters, were intimately involved in their honor and in negotiations concerning their future. So it, sort of at an early age, they were learning the responsibility of the man in regards to the women folk in the house. And as Laban was involved in those with his father concerning sister Rebecca. Here we see the sons of Jacob also involved in this discussion. We see also it's told us here that when Jacob heard about it, he held his peace. It may simply mean that he was said nothing until everyone was gathered to discuss it. However, that's all we hear about him. What we do hear, though, about the brothers is something quite different. They were incensed over this outrage that had been committed. Verse 7, when they heard about it, they weren't silent in the sense that they just took the news and whatever. They were grieved deeply. It doesn't tell us Jacob was grieved. It doesn't tell us that Jacob, like them, was very wroth because they wrought folly in Israel in lying with Jacob's daughter, which thing ought not to be done. This was an evil, wicked thing that Shechem did. And verse 7 tells us that in these negotiations, where the brothers are coming from, what their mindset is, or as it were, what their emotions are, they approach these marriage negations as angry men who are outraged, who are grieved at what has happened. And that helps us understand in verse 13, when they begin to give their answer, they answer deceitfully. They're being driven by their anger. Angry people want what? Revenge. That saying, I don't get angry, I get even, isn't true. What they're saying is, I get angry and I get even. And they're angry and they want revenge. And so that's what's behind their minds in this. Also, as we look at the negotiations, we have to be somewhat impressed by the reasonableness and the sincerity of Hamor and Shechem. As they come and seek to do this in a proper fashion. You know, there's one thing that is very important in this whole negotiation, is that's verse 26. Where's Dinah when these negotiations are taking place? Safely in her father's household? No. She is in the house of Shechem. In a sense, they have her. And in that sense, they're negotiating from a position of strength. They've got a whole city of men. They can, you know, they can defend themselves if Jacob and his sons decide they want to take her by force. And also the brothers, we have to realize, see themselves in a position of weakness. In other words, if they say no to these negotiations, what they're going to, they expect corrupt Canaanites and this man who has just fallen head over heels over her, just, okay, we'll turn her over. So there's more than meets the eye here, and there's enough blame in this whole chapter to go around. Shechem and Hamor are not, from this point, I'm not reading to say and become very sympathetic to them because of the apparently honorable way in which they're going about things. If we look closely at this whole thing, they are not as honorable as they may appear. And the sons of Jacob are dealing with Canaanite corrupt people. It does not negate their sin nor the enormity of their crime. It just puts it in context. Just understand a little bit of the dynamics that are working here in this situation. But they do not approach it in that way. That is, Hamor and Shechem, that is, we have her, we're going to take her, tough luck. They do come and seek to properly, honorably arrange a marriage. In fact, Shechem says there in verse 11 that just name the bride price. I'll pay anything. Just give me this young woman to be my wife. Well, we see the answer of the sons of Jacob in verse 13, which is deceitful, and they talk to them about the fact that we cannot do this because we're a circumcised people. I don't know if they explained about the Abrahamic covenant and faith and all that, but it's certainly not given in the text. And given the motivation, it seems, for why they give this whole spiel about circumcision, they weren't interested in the religious aspect. They had a plan. The plan was if these people would consent to this, they knew the men would be incapacitated after a few days because of the pain that they were in, and they would then, in that state, be defenseless. So it may appear that they're using the holy ordinance of circumcision as a ruse, merely to advance their agenda of revenge. The thing is surprising to them, probably. They probably were taking this as an opportunity. I would have to say they were surprised when Shechem and Hamor agreed to this. And they agreed to this. They go to the men of the city. They discuss it with them. The men of the city also receive it. But it's interesting how the difference of negotiations here, or the difference in which Hamor and Shechem negotiate with the men of the city concerning this proposed deal, which, if you'll note, was to merge the two peoples into one. This was not just the marriage between Dinah and Shechem, but that they would become one people and share. And so they begin by speaking of the economic advantages. And so, in fact, they don't even mention the whole negotiations about what Shechem had done and about what their own desires are. Leading that insightful commentator, John Calvin, to say this, that is, they were enumerating the advantages, but they didn't mention the true motivation here. But it is a very common disease that men of rank who have great authority, while making all things subservient to their own private ends, feign themselves to be considerate for the common good and pretend to desire for the public advantage. Magistrates haven't changed. Nothing new under the sun. They had their own advantage in line here. Well, the rest of the story we read, Simeon and Levi come, slaughter the men of the city. But not only do that, and this even seems to me to add to the crime, they then go and spoil the city. They plunder it, take their wealth, seize the wives and children for slaves and servants, and they make their way off from the city there. Jacob is rightfully, and we're told this in verse 30 because it helps us understand Jacob had no part in these plans. He did not approve of this. Jacob is weak in this chapter, but he's not wickedly vengeful. And he is greatly incensed. And I think that he reproved these sons quite a bit. He mentions, and what we have recorded for us here is what you have actually done. And this perhaps will wake the brothers up in enormity of the crime. You've signed your own death warrant in this. This is foolishness. For now, the inhabitants of the land, we're only a few, but all around us, the Canaanites and the Perizzites, they'll gather themselves together and they will avenge this wrong done to those of Canaan by we, an outside family. They will slay me and I shall be destroyed, I and my house. Who is Jacob? His household. Jacob is the heir of the Abrahamic covenant. His household is the household wherein that covenant will descend. And so here we have again danger. Very dangerous situation. Extremely dangerous situation. And he is rightfully alarmed at that and rebukes his sons. A couple of things here to note by way of application. We again see here, as I've already mentioned, though, the types of circumstances that arise in a divided household. Who were the ones that took up for Dinah? It was her natural brothers, not her half-brothers. But it was Levi and Simeon, who were also born of Leah to Jacob. They are the ones who are active in this thing. We see Jacob strangely passive when it comes to the outrage against his daughter Dinah. And we see the sad results of it all. God planned for a family to be united, to be one husband, one wife, and their children working together in common cause, supporting one another, taking each other forward. Instead, we see this household of Jacob torn by jealousies and rivalries and factions. And perhaps, too, we see Jacob here who gives himself the lead in allowing this to happen in his own household. Perhaps if Jacob would have taken a firm lead in these whole negotiations, if he would have rebuked Shechem and he would have refused to give Dinah as a daughter and all these things, none of this would have happened. So that's why I say I believe in this chapter Jacob does not look good. He's passive, but passive, being passive can also be wrong. Furthermore, this chapter shows us, gives us a picture here of what can happen in society, among men, in the community, here as it is in the community of Shechem, when God's law does not govern in the society. Remember when Moses wrote this is when Israel's at Sinai. And he's going to be giving to them public civil law for the governance of their country. And one of those laws is going to cover this exact situation. Look with me to Exodus 22:16. When I say exact, perhaps I should say related. Similar situation. It's a similar situation. And when you have case law, that's all you need. Exodus 22:16. And if a man entice a maid that is not betrothed and lie with her, he shall surely endow her to be his wife. If his father utterly refuse to give her unto him, he shall pay money according to the dowry of virgins. This is further expanded in Deuteronomy 22:28 later on. That is later on in terms of the historical working of giving of the law. 40 years later, when Israel was second generation after the Exodus was about to enter the land. In Deuteronomy 22:28. If a man find a damsel that is a virgin, which is not betrothed, and lay hold of her and lie with her, and they be found. Then the man that lay with her shall give unto the damsel's father 50 shekels of silver. And she shall be his wife, because he hath humbled her. He may not put her away all his days. So here we have two laws referring to the same situation. Two case laws referring to the same situation, explaining what God, the righteous judge of all the earth, ordains for this type of situation that we have. Dinah was an unbetrothed virgin, and this man Shechem took her. He was a Canaanite, and that may complicate the situation if we get into the idea, which is later explicit in the law of not giving in marriage to Canaanites, though that had not specifically been given yet, that law, though it had been... The example had been set by Abraham in sending for a wife for his son back to their family. But anyway, it says here, in this law, the father, first of all, the father has the right of refusal in such a circumstance. If he judges that this man and this circumstance is not advantageous at all to his daughter, and that the best course is to refuse any relationship, no marriage, he has the authority to do it. The father has the authority of refusal in this marriage, and may I add, by case law, in any marriage. If he refuses, the man needs to pay 50 shekels of silver, which, as we talked about earlier when we looked at Jacob's bride price, is a large sum of money, very large. A number of years' wages. And I also think that... Depending on all the circumstances in such a case, Deuteronomy 22:18 may apply as well in another case law when it talks about this the kinds of take the man and flog him. Flogging was used in the Old Testament, and it seems to me that its usage was in terms of violence. That is, violent crimes that were committed. Somebody wasn't killed. Somebody wasn't so forth, but they may have been assaulted and injured. Not only were they to make restitution for the man's injuries, but they were and could be, according to the judge's determination, publicly flogged, though there was a limit put on how many lashes they could receive. And so this man who lay with this, I think the judges had discretion, as in this other case law, to flog the young man publicly for his crime. But the father might agree. And according to these laws, if he agrees, the bride price will be 50 shekels of silver, and he is denied the right of divorce, which puts the woman pretty much in a position of power in the household. And the Deuteronomy 24:1 that says if a man finds uncleanness, something disgraceful in his wife, he can divorce her, is out the window for him. And so it's a very hard penalty. That is, if you live with a woman who's disgraceful. Otherwise, that provision doesn't matter. If you've got a godly wife, who cares? But it is a... In other words, it's a very negative sanction against the man. It undermines all of his authority. not all of it, but it undermines his authority in the home. So, the actions of the brothers were terribly unjust. God's law did not mandate even death in this situation. Jacob and his sons, Jacob by his passive behavior and his sons by their action, acted contrary to God's law. And they slew an entire city or town because of one man's crime, which even that crime was not punishable by death. Another thing to remember as we look at this in the sense of what Moses is going to be showing the people, here's what happens when God's law is thrown out. People are governed by what? Passions. Passions of Shechem. The passions of the brothers of Dinah. I'm sorry to say, but for those who would advocate natural law as the guide for society, have going to have troubles with Genesis 34. Because here we see men acting according to what came natural in the situation. Natural law is based on the fact that men act reasonably. But men do not act reasonably. They act according, sinful men act according to their passions and their lusts and their motivations. And those things are far stronger than their reason. What is needed are the chains of biblical law administered by godly magistrates, not left open to reason and debate. But thus saith the judge of all the earth, here is my law, here are the penalties for its breach. God's law would have been followed in this situation, and we would have had a far different outcome. My thinking would have been they would have simply refused Dinah to Shechem, demanded the payment of the fine compensation, and that had been the end of the matter. But it didn't happen. Also, we're told when God's law is followed, as Moses later tells the people in Deuteronomy 5, 4, verses 5 throughout, that when the nations look and see how Israel conducts themselves in civil cases and these type of circumstances, they will say, wow, what a wise and understanding people. That is a really a just way to deal with this. Wonder who their God is. We need to get to know more about Israel and their God. In other words, the obedience to God's law is said to be a witness to the nations. But what did their actions do in terms of their witness here in Genesis 34? Jacob's right on target. You've made a stink in the nostrils of the people of the land, and they're going to come and kill us. They're going to come and kill us. Chapter 35 shows that they do not kill them. Let's read down through verse 5. And God said unto Jacob, arise and go to Bethel and dwell there, and make there an altar unto God that appeared unto thee when thou fleddest from the face of Esau thy brother. Then Jacob said unto his household and to all that were with him, put away the strange gods that are among you, and be clean, and change your garments. And let us arise and go up to Bethel. I will make there an altar unto God, who answered me in the day of my distress, and was with me in the way which I went. And they gave Jacob all the strange gods which were in their hand, and all the earrings which were in their ears, and Jacob hid them under the oak which was by Shechem. And they journeyed, and the terror of God was upon the cities that were around about them, and they did not pursue after the sons of Jacob. Why would they pursue after them? This verse is referring to the real danger that was occasioned by the wicked, vengeful murders committed by the sons of Jacob in verse 30 when he said, they will destroy us. And what we have here is these people are burning with vengeance against Jacob, and they would like to kill him, but the terror of God comes upon them and they won't move. God is faithful. I will be with you, Jacob. I will return you to your father's house. I will deliver you from Laban. I will deliver you from Esau. And I will deliver you from even the lusts of the Canaanites, your own passive failure, and the sins of your sons. Because my promise triumphs over all. And so here we have in this chapter the end of the journey for Isaac. What is the end of the journey in that he returns to his father's household? and the end of the journey for Jacob, and he returns to his father's household, and the end of the journey for Isaac, and that he returns to his father's. He is buried with Abraham. The end of the chapter. The chapter begins here with Jacob returning to Bethel to fulfill his vow, as we read here in the earlier verses we just read. Jacob begins, as he says, as God has appeared to him and commanded him now to go up to Bethel to fulfill that vow that he made and for God to fulfill his promise in bringing him back. And Jacob begins by commanding his household to prepare to go to Bethel to worship the Lord. And the thing that they are to do is to put away the strange gods. Remember, Rachel had stolen the family idols from her father Laban. We're not exactly sure why. But it does seem to indicate, at least to some degree, that she had not been able to cast off all of these things. And she was a polytheist to some degree. Though Jehovah may have been, as she understood, the chief deity. We wish the Bible would explain this a little bit better. But we do see that there were strange gods, idols, that were being worshipped within the household. That would not only be his wives, sons, but that would include also the servants who would have come from different backgrounds and no doubt had their idols and their gods. But Jacob, aware of this, and it's something that he has tolerated, he finally decides he can tolerate it no more. God has been faithful to him. He must cleanse his house of all of these things. And they must be put out from among us. We must be clean, he says to his family, to his household. We must be clean. And we must change our garments. And he's referring here to washing and new garments. And these are symbolic of the cleansing that is necessary, morally speaking. The purification necessary before they go to worship the Lord. Jacob, here's another example to us, fathers, husbands. That we ourselves may have tolerated strange things. Strange things that are contrary to the law and will of Jehovah within our household. They were maybe not real bad, but they were there. And as Jacob, we have tolerated those. May God bring us to the Jacob-type decision where that will be tolerated no more. And our houses will be cleansed. And then Jacob explains to them in verse 3, the household, why they're going to Bethel, where they're going and why. We're going to Bethel. I'm going to make an altar there to God. He had answered me in the day of my distress. That goes back to the when he fled from Esau, chapter 28. And in there we did not have any indication that he was praying before the vision of Jacob's ladder. But this tells us he was. As he left in distress, having to flee for his life from his own brother, leaving his household, going out with nothing but a staff in his hand to a strange land many miles away, in his distress, he prayed. He prayed. Jacob, for his faults, knew this, that when you're in distress, you turn to God. And he did. And the Lord heard him and answered his prayer and revealed himself in Jacob's ladder. And he went with me in everything that I've done. And let us go. And so in verse 6, he comes to Luz, which is in the land of Canaan. That is Bethel. Its original name was Luz. It's been renamed Bethel by Jacob because that means house of God. He and all the people that were with him. His whole family is there this time. When he went there before, it was one man. Now he comes a rich man with servants, wives, and children. God has brought him back. He went out empty. He came back full. And he brings them to the altar. There he builds an altar. There he calls that altar now El Bethel. Before he just called the place Bethel, house of God. Now he calls it El Bethel, the house of Almighty God. Because he has learned through experience that God is almighty. And he has protected and blessed him in every circumstance and in every way. And they were told also this interesting note that Deborah, Rebekah's nurse, died. Rebekah was his mother. Deborah was the one who went with, though the name wasn't given, back in chapter 24 when Rebekah left her family to come to marry Isaac. But here we find, all of a sudden, that woman in the household of Jacob. And we do not know why she is there. There's different things that we can surmise. Perhaps I think the best that I've heard is that this is the indication that Rebekah is dead. Her death is nowhere recorded. And that Deborah, who would have been Rebekah's nurse, no doubt was one of those who cared for and raised Jacob. And like her mistress, Rebekah, she loved Jacob. And at the death of Rebekah, she sought out. She heard that Jacob was in the land. She sought him out and she attached herself to Jacob's household. And here she died. And the very fact that this is mentioned, again, also suggests that she was a godly woman, a woman who meant much to Jacob in the family. And he buries her and he names the place of the burial the Oak of Weeping. His heart is broken over the loss of Deborah. But it also might be the indication that it reminds him that he, when he went out, it was to be for a short time, and then he was going to see Rebekah, his mother, again, but he never will. Not only is she dead now, her nurse is gone. And then we have Jacob in his worship here, building an altar. And altars are built to give sacrifices, worshiping the Lord. In verses 9 to 15, God appears to Jacob now at Bethel for the second time. And God appeared to Jacob again when he came out of Padan Aram and blessed him. This appearance is, as verse 15 tells us, Bethel. It's picturing coming out of the east, back into Canaan, and at Bethel. And God said to him, "Thy name is Jacob. Thy name shall be not be called anymore Jacob, but Israel shall be thy name." And he called his name Israel. This is a reaffirmation of what we saw last week when he was given the name of Israel. And we saw that the name of Israel probably does not mean Prince of God, Prince with God. But it means the one who perseveres with God. The one who struggles, wrestles ultimately with God in all of his trials, but he perseveres and will not let go until the blessing is granted by God, the covenantal blessings. And the mark of a true Israelite is perseverance. Hebrews teaches that. Because there were some who said they were true Israelites, but they were tempted to fall away. And the writer of Hebrews says, if you fall away, you have never had the faith. But the true believer perseveres. And that's what the word Israel means. One who perseveres with God. Faith is not a here today, gone tomorrow proposition. Salvation is not going to an altar and praying. That may be a point of conversion. But it's a lifelong perseverance in the faith. The New Testament says, not he who believes one time shall be saved, but he that continues, who or present tense, is going on in their faith, will be saved. This is what we mean by the perseverance of the saints from the human perspective, from the divine perspective, which enables perseverance, the preservation of the saints. In verse 11, we see a strange command be given to a man who is 110 years old about. Already has 11 sons, and he's about to have another one born in a minute. Be fruitful and multiply. Be fruitful and multiply. Third time that command is given in Genesis. It was given earlier to Adam and Eve. It was then given to Noah and his sons. And now it's given to Jacob. Be fruitful and multiply. Why would God command Jacob that? Simply this, that he will command his household after him. His days of bearing are at an end, coming to an end with the final birth of his son Benjamin. But he is to command his sons, his family, to be fruitful and multiply. And of course, that command to fruitful and multiply was always tied in with the dominion mandate earlier on. God continues to reiterate the promises of the Abrahamic covenant to Jacob here at Bethel by speaking about the fact that out of him will be a nation and a company of nations. It seems as though the nation here is easy to understand. That's Israel. But what are these other company of nations? There were no other peoples that descended from Jacob. Do we have here the suggestion of the idea of covenant nations that will come to pass? Not in the same way that Israel became a covenant nation, but the way in which nations will be discipled under the gospel. Disciple the nations! Bring the nations to my feet that they might worship me and acknowledge me as King and Lord. Is this what's being spoken of here? Yes, there will be the nation of Israel, but a company of nations shall descend from you. Not in the sense of physical descent, but in the sense of the covenant. And of faith. He also, like he promised Abraham, the king shall come out of thy loins. A clear reference to the Davidic line, which of course is sealed by the Davidic covenant, which points to ultimately to the King of Kings, Jesus Christ. And then the promise of the land, and the land which I gave Abraham and Isaac, to thee I will give it. To thy seed after thee will I give the land. And God went up from him in the place where he talked with him, and Jacob set up a pillar in the place where he talked with him, even a pillar of stone, and he poured a drink offering thereon, and he poured oil thereon, and Jacob called the name of the place where God spake with him, Bethel. And they journeyed from Bethel, and there was but a little way to come to Ephrathah. Wait a minute, Ephrath. And Rachel travailed, and she had hard labor. And it came to pass, when she was in hard labor, that the midwife said unto her, Fear not, thou shalt have this son also. And it came to pass, as her soul was departing, for she died, that she called his name Benoni. But his father called him Benjamin. Benoni meaning son of my father, Benjamin, son of my sorrow. Benjamin meaning son of my right hand. And Rachel died and was buried in the way of Ephrath, which is Bethlehem. And Jacob set up a pillar upon her grave. That is the pillar of Rachel's grave unto this day. So here we come to the end of the life of Rachel. There's something very striking about this. Do you remember what Rachel said to Jacob back in chapter 30? She said to Jacob, Give me children or I die. Jacob said, I'm not in the place of God. I can't give you children. So this dear woman who pled, give me children or I die. It turns out that it was ultimately the gift of children that killed her. God answered her prayer. He gave her children. But in the gift of that second child, she died. Continuing as we finish this section, and Israel journeyed and spread his tent beyond the Tower of Edar. And it came to pass when Israel dwelt in the land that Reuben went and lay with Bilhah, his father's concubine. And Israel heard it. Jacob heard it. So he did anything. Now the sons of Jacob were 12. Now this is a very sorry event that is just mentioned here in the passage. But who was Bilhah? Bilhah was Rachel's maid. And many believe that Reuben was not in any way motivated here by lust. But he was doing something far different. It was sinful. It was evil. It was a form of incest. Condemned. So not. But what he was doing here is, and I think this is probably the explanation, is he was seeking by this act of defiling Bilhah to make sure that she didn't rise up now and take Rachel's place because she was Rachel's maid as the favored wife of the family. Reuben was seeking to protect his mother, Leah, by defiling Rachel's maid, who may have, he feared, stepped into the place now of favored wife, once again thwarting Leah from the position he wanted. If that's the case, again, do we see what has happened in this family? Oh, it doesn't end. And it won't end either, because we're going to have brothers selling their other brother into slavery in our next section. The sons of Jacob are then given, listed here. This is not only to show the fulfillment of the promise of fruitfulness, but I believe it paves the way for the Joseph narrative that is to come, reminding us who was born to who. And then finally the journey ends. And Jacob came unto Isaac his father, unto Mamre, unto the city of Arba, which is Hebron, where Abraham and Isaac sojourned. There he finds Isaac. After all of these years, he was away for 20 years in Haran. And a number of years have passed since then. And he has finally returned. God has fulfilled his promise. By looking at the chronology of the Bible, Jacob was probably about 108 years old or 110 when he arrived home. And so when we're told in the next verses about the death of Isaac, if the days of Isaac were 180 years, this would tell us, since Jacob was born when Isaac was 60, that he may have had 10 or 12 years there with his father in Hebron. And then his father dies, gives up the ghost, his journey is over, he's kept the faith, and he's gathered unto his people, being old and full of days. And this touching note, his sons Esau and Jacob, the reconciled brothers, who no doubt have enjoyed the fruits of that reconciliation for these years since Jacob came back, joined together in this act of love and devotion to their father, and they lay him to rest. Isaac's journey is over. And Jacob's journey back home is over as well. And with the death of Isaac, he would inherit the family headship. and the wealth. And the household of Isaac's becomes that of Jacob. This leads the way and prepares for the story to come, the generations of Jacob, beginning in chapter 37. Let's pray. Father, again, as we've looked at the narrative of Scripture, we've pulled out a few applications and thoughts, yet so much is in these chapters. Guide us as we continue to meditate upon your word. Teach us the riches of your word for those who are willing to mine for it and to find it. Thank you for the story of the generations of Isaac, the Jacob narratives, all that you've taught us through them. Fortify us for our faith, for our race, for our journey, for our wrestling. May we be true Israelites who will not let you go, Lord, unless you bless us. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Let's turn now to our time of interaction. We will entertain questions and comments from the covenanting members of the church concerning our account here of Shechem and the final journey home for Jacob. Do you have any questions or comments from the membership? Yes, Gary?
I really enjoyed the sermon today, and it was very enlightening in some of these issues here. The one thing that I would agree with you that the sons of Jacob, or the sons of Leah there, acted improperly in their murder and so on. One thing I've always appreciated about them is their sense of responsibility towards their sister. And that's something I don't think we see a lot of in our culture today. We don't see a lot of sons who really feel that
toward their sisters,
sense of responsibility to defend their sisters.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And that's something that is very challenging to me because that's something I never felt.
Yeah.
And I have four younger sisters than mm-hmm. I. And then the other thing is, it's also something I'd like to cultivate in my sons' mm-hmm. lives as well,
yes.
that they would feel that responsibility. So I just say that for what it's worth. I don't yeah. have all the answers, but
right.
somehow we've got to change
yeah.
the culture we're living in that respect.
Yeah, I think that their reaction that's recorded in Genesis 34 about being very wroth and grieved was godly. What happened is that turned into vengeance. The anger turned into vengeance, and they were driven by that passion rather than the consideration of the matter. If they would have killed Shechem, there would be at least a flicker of understanding that there's justice to some degree there. But they killed the whole city. And that is not sort of a shocking event, as I said. It's one of the more gruesome, shocking events in Scripture, what they did.
And I've wondered to what extent that really was, that really is a part of the cultural milieu rather than something that should be universal. I've wondered in connection with this about the Song of Solomon, where there are several passages detailing the brother's concern for the Shulamite, but the father of the Shulamite is never mentioned in the book. This provides an interesting corollary to that. And I don't know if you've done any thought or if maybe we can discuss this afterwards. To what extent is that just cultural?
Yeah.
And to what extent should it continue? Maybe not in this formal sense of the brothers arranging the marriage of their sister. But at any rate, to be a lot more responsible than they are.
You certainly foster unity among the brothers and sisters. If you knew your brother was going to be helping arrange your marriage, you'd be kind to him. But seriously, about God's law, though, we do have the incident or the case law there in Exodus 22 where the brothers are not mentioned at all in terms of if the father refused, which would seem to me that really that closes the question for me. To have brothers involved certainly would seem appropriate, but authority they do not have. However, being a case law means you apply the basic equity in the law to varying situations. What if there's no father? what would seem to devolve to some degree to the mother, but needing the male perspective, if there's sons, that they would step in there, and if there's no mother in a situation where both parents were killed, and that kind of thing would often happen in the old day, and that brothers had taken the household, that they would be the ones who would have that authority in that situation. She would not be defenseless if her father was gone. Because it seems to me if the father refuses, it's not that he, in some objective way, detached from the circumstances and his daughter's wishes, discusses it. It seemed to me his refusal would be have a lot to do with his daughter's whole perspective on what had just happened in that event. You know? And so he's there to protect her, to help her, to guide her, and to consider her in that. It's not some tyrannical type headship that a father has over his daughter. But it is a headship. And even if she would want the marriage to go forward, he still has the authority, even if she's opposed to it, that is opposed to his decision to not let it go forward. He still has to do that. Gary, you want to? Yes.
Yeah, I knew of a situation very well where a young Christian girl, a young Christian man wanted to marry a young woman, and he desired to do it biblically and went to her father, who was not a Christian, and asked for her hand in marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And her father refused to take responsibility in the situation and told him, well, go ask her. You know, she's mm-hmm. she's the one that has to give you the answer, not me. And he refused to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
And he was very grieved by that because mm-hmm. he felt like it should be the father.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, it happened that this young woman had a brother who was a Christian and it was older than herself. And so the young man went to him and asked him, because you know he really wanted to do this under authority, and asked him if he would act in the father's role, which he then consented to do, and it turned out to be a beautiful marriage.
Mm.
So I just give you that as an example.
Amen. One thing I hope that the story of Jacob will show us is the necessity of us laboring for unity in our household. Even though we may have a marriage and it's with one man and one woman, the husband and wife might be going opposite poles. And it can be just as divided, just as many jealousies, just not as many, but jealousies and rivalries dictating things in the family as we saw in Jacob's household. It can be that the sons and the daughters or the sons against certain sons, there's all kinds of divisions that can arise in a home. And that one of our shepherding of our families is to begin by making sure the husband and wife are together. And labor for that. A man who thinks his headship is just telling the family where to go without his wife's consent is sowing the seeds of family dissension. Because it doesn't matter what the theory is or what the theology is. It has to be played out for it to work. And so our goal is to lead our wives, to gently guide them, bring them along in the truth so that we will be one with them and have unity, which will then extend to our children. And also we're warned against favoritism, parents picking out their favorite and showering it. And that's really going to come evident in the story with Joseph. Jacob's brought great grief upon himself and Joseph, though it was all in God's providence. Thank God he's over all of this, that we must not have favoritism. But just one act after another in Jacob's home plagued because of the division, which... In Jacob's defense, he did not want. He was tricked. He was given the so-called short end of the stick by Laban. And in some ways, this father-in-law, Laban, is a great cause of a lot of grief. But the miracle of God's sovereignty shines through all the sins of men, and his plan marches forward. This time we'll have our concluding hymn, number 505.